The alternative media, exposing government corruption, defending our suspended constitution, demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth. The puppet media dare not report. Long live liberty and death to the new world order. Prepare yourself. This is the alternative media. This is the alternative media, exposing government corruption, defending our suspicion.
Well, hey, gang. Welcome to the latest episode of National Bugle Radio. And this week I'm here with Eric Stryker, the Daily Stormer journalist, and George from Greece.
Yeah, I live here in New York now, so.
Yes, indeed. And we are going to talk about two or more topics. We're going to be talking about the faked sarin gas report, the faked evidence that General McMaster has produced and that General Mathis has cited in justifying the missile strike on Syria that is really at the core of this Jewish coup d'etat or this Jew d'etat that took place earlier this month, where these Jews have taken over the Trump administration, but we're going to try to wrestle it back from them. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about some other things, what's going on in Auburn. But, Eric, you wrote an article about this fake report and the evidence that is presented by a well-known MIT professor completely debunking this McMaster report. Would you like to introduce that?
Yeah, so there's this well-respected weapons expert from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Theodore Postol. P-O-S-T-O-L. Theodore Postol. Okay.
Indeed. And he was very convinced that this was nothing but a hoax, that the rebels released the sarin themselves. And Mr. Postol was, he got
Dr.
his hands
Postol
on
to you.
The intelligence.
Dr. Yes? Postol. Professor Postol.
Ah, there we go. Well, he got his hands on the supposed intelligence that proved Assad was guilty of the sarin gas attack. Well, this bulletproof intelligence turned out to be a single picture of a hole in the ground with an open can that had a skull and crossbones on it. This was the entire dossier of evidence they used to blame Assad for the gas attack. So Professor Postol basically looked at this and laughed, just like everyone else would. This is why, whether it's Russia or the gas attack, they keep the intelligence a secret, and they say, oh, you can't see it, it's top secret. Well, he saw it, and his assessment was the gas attack was either done by the rebels themselves, or it was staged, because there was no signs of a munition inside of the sarin gas can that would ignite it from the sky. So it was blown up, or it was just an empty can that was left in that crater in the street, done from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, this is a hoax.
Now, Eric, did it really have a skull and crossbones on it? Are you saying that like a...
Well, they added that. No. They added a skull and cross. Here's the amusing thing. There's a video floating around of white helmets going,
yeah,
and rescue workers around this crater. And I'm not saying it's even a crater. This is more like a New York City pothole. That's what it looks like. And they put this skull and crossbow sign on it just to remind you that there's sarin gas on it. But here's the thing. The people around the crater are not wearing masks, or if they are, they're wearing those cheap masks that you put on with the band. They're not suited up. He also stated that all the people in that video would have been dead if that was sarin.
Right. So the White House, on, I believe it was the 11th of April, had released this assessment called the White House Report. And it included pictures, and it included the picture that Mr. Stryker is talking about. You have this crater, you have this gray tube that's been crushed, and it has a rupture lengthwise along it. And then there is a square red sign right next to it with a skull and crossbones and something written in Arabic underneath it. This is presented as evidence that President Assad gassed his own people. And the point that's being made is any competent expert, any competent analyst in this field would know that if this was a missile, a projectile that had blown through the sky and fell from the air and exploded, it explodes from the inside out, so you would have things that are pushed out. This is crushed. It's as if you had a tube of toothpaste that had the cap on and somebody stepped on it. So you would have a crushed tube of toothpaste with a rupture in it. You know, a rupture along the seam, for instance. And that's exactly what this looks like. It's crushed. It's not exploded outward. It is crushed. And Professor Postol says the only explanation for this would be if you had a tube that perhaps was filled with sarin, but a tube and then on top of it an explosive charge. And then the explosive charge is detonated. It creates the crater, and then it crushes that tube below it. And if that tube is sealed and has something inside of it, like a liquid, which you can't crush liquids, so toothpaste in the tube, it would rupture that tube and come out. You know, I am not an expert in these things, but it seems that even a novice who is informed of this can say, yeah, that looks right, that looks logical. He says, even though the intelligence services have been politicized, they still include many, many competent people that would have caught this mistake. Now, somebody like McMaster or whatever few people he had working with him, or perhaps Mossad agents who fed this to him, who knows where he got it from, not being experts in the field, not being experts at this type of forensics, might have just made up a story like this, not realizing how easily it could be debunked. But this was very easily debunked.
We remember the yellow cake intelligence that was given to Bush on the eve of the Iraq War, and we also remember the Jews that were in the New York Times spreading rumors that were started by Iraqi dissidents about Saddam Hussein's nuclear capabilities in 2002. I mean, I'm getting deja vu from this thing. I don't know about you.
Yeah, big time.
Deja vu. I mean, this is like typical gassing his own people. He's got weapons of mass destruction. The only thing I would ask that if I were to be neutral and like trying to look at it from both sides is how did the crater, it's a small crater, like I told George, it looks like a pothole in a street. Like you see these kinds of potholes when you're going to JFK Airport. So,
well, you know, it might not even be in Syria. It could be a pothole in Brooklyn in a Hasidic Jew neighborhood that they took a picture of. How do we know? You know?
Yeah.
Might as well. Right?
So that's the only thing they could possibly question Dr. Postol on. Is say, okay, well, if this was just crushed from the inside, how did this crater get there? Maybe they used something.
The explosive was on top of it. That it was the explosive that was placed on top of the tube that crushed the tube and created the crater.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. Yeah, they possibly put it next to it or on top of it. Right.
And
like a dirty bomb type thing, like a... Yeah. Real, like, homemade-looking type of thing, in other words.
Yeah, and these pictures, they're from what they call open-source video. Well, open-source video, it means YouTube. This is just YouTube. This is just ISIS YouTube or Al-Qaeda YouTube.
Yeah, that one clip is in Arabic, and they have the warning signs around it, and people are walking around, going by their daily business like it's nothing. You know, there's supposedly remnants of a sarin gas attack there. And I don't see people foaming at the mouth. They're walking around like it's nothing.
Right.
So.
And they have video of them removing bird cages with dead birds. The implication being that they had placed live birds in bird cages inside this crater. And because of the remnants of the sarin, the birds died. The proverbial canary.
They show a dead dog as well. And they show Arabic men sleeping like they got the flu or something. But I believe that the actual effects of sarin are far more significant than you just being bedridden for a couple of days.
Right. And then,
guys, do you remember, like, I think it was about 2 years ago or maybe more, they had tried a similar hoax like this with Syria. I remember watching it on TV where they showed a bunch of people in the hospital that looked like they'd been gassed.
Yes,
it was like old footage from something else, and they were trying to say that Assad did it. Do you recall that? I can't remember exactly the date.
It came out later on. Actually, a righteous Jew named Seymour Hersh traced. It was an actual. There was a gas attack. I believe it was chlorine gas, not sarin. And this one righteous Jew, a good Jew, he actually traced the attack back to chemicals produced in Turkey, given to the rebels, given to Al-Qaeda, and they dropped it in a civilian area. And there was a bit of a staging that went along with that. It was coordinated.
Right.
I mean, this stinks of the same thing. And you know that the Jews in the media know it because they're in a rush to attack Syria. They're not waiting for the investigation. Because let's say that a leader in a civil war using a chemical attack is grounds for war. Let's pretend we live in that bizarre world. If it was, wouldn't you want to investigate it? Especially if that leader is denying culpability and they're rushing. They're like, no, there can't be an investigation. We have to strike now. We can't let Putin win the propaganda war. It's fake news. Well, you know, get the United Nations to look into it like they did with the one you're talking about 2 years ago. And when they looked into it back then, they found that their results were quote-unquote inconclusive, mm-hmm. which means that it was probably the rebels.
Right.
But it wasn't Assad. That was for sure. It wasn't Assad.
What I believe you're referring to is this 2013 incident. And Professor Postol, at the time, was working for the Pentagon as an analyst. He was an expert advisor to the chief of naval operations, I believe, at the time. And he points out that these munitions that were supposedly shot by the Assad forces in this area of Damascus, where the alleged chemical attack took place, that these munitions only had a 2,000-meter range. And the Syrian government didn't control any territory anywhere near 2,000 meters from this attack.
I mean, aside from the nitty-gritty technical stuff that an MIT weapons expert would know about, and sides with Assad on, let's look at it from a logical point of view. This has been said several times.
Where's the motive?
Where's the motive? Because according to the Semitic bill of the New York Times, Assad is actually a Hollywood villain who saw that Rex Tillerson was going to allow him to stay in power, and so because he's so evil, he dropped this gas to test him. But if that were true, why is the Syrian government adamantly, they're not just denying it, they're adamantly denying it, calling for the United Nations to investigate it, and saying that basically the United States' CIA joined forces with the Al-Qaeda rebels to stage this hoax. So there is no motive, there is no technical proof that it was Assad, and there's really no reason for America to be attacking Assad, even if it was true. What makes a chemical weapon any worse than a MOB? You know, the mother of all bombs. Why is that okay?
You're still just as dead either way, right?
Well, one of them is an actual weapon of mass destruction. The other one is actually pretty limited in its scope in terms of how destructive it can be. So there's lots of hypocrisy to go around here. But I think it's important to note that Trump appears to have gotten a little, you know, I think what we should talk about a little bit is about Trump and what he could have been doing with this. Because he himself obviously knows that this is BS. And he did pivot from his campaign promises. So what do you guys think his motive was with this?
I would think going along with what he's been told now, they kind of have ganged up on him. That's my best guess. I don't know what you think, Dr. Slattery.
Before I get into what I think, you had mentioned also the yellow cake uranium that is famous for President Bush using to get us into the war in Iraq in 2003. He had talked about this in his 2003 State of the Union address, and he talked about yellow cake uranium from a country in Africa. And, of course, the documents that were supposedly showing that there had been this trade agreement, first of all, they had the date on the documents did not match with the day of the week. It was supposedly signed by the foreign minister of Niger, but on the date that it was signed, the man was no longer foreign minister. The document was in French and contained all sorts of French grammatical mistakes that just would not be in a diplomatic or business document. It contains so many obvious flaws, and it raises the question, like with this recent easily debunked report, why can't they do a better job of faking things? And, I mean, you would think that, but...
Yeah, good question.
But this postal report sheds light on why that would be the case, that McMaster did not go to the U.S. intelligence services, to the CIA or the Defense Intelligence Agency or anything else, even though these agencies have been politicized, there's still a lot of competent people, and not everybody's been politicized. And the more you seek experts, you know, the wider the circle of the conspiracy gets. And so you might be getting a more credible, faked report, but you're compromising operational security by bringing in these expert opinions. And this is just a guess, but I would tend to think that the people with the most expertise are going to be the people who are most committed to their trade and are going to be the least likely to want to go along with such a fake. I mean, don't you think so?
I would actually argue that in modern day America, most experts, quote unquote, or better yet, more accurately, parentheses, generally speaking, a lot of the most elite experts, they exist basically to push the party line, which is why Dr. Postol's report really caught my attention, because this opens him up to being accused of being a Russian agent, to being accused of being a partisan, to being accused of all kinds of things, even hurting his career in some subtle or even overt ways. But he took a brave stand here by, you know, basically stating the obvious. But, you know, he's got the little paper that says he's an expert, and, and that matters a lot.
There's probably dozens
highly
of these experts
in his field.
There's probably dozens of these experts, but he's probably the only one that stood forward and said, you know what, something's not right here, when the other ones just kept their mouths shut, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
where are the other ones?
You would think there would be people in the CIA or other intelligence services who would step forward. But if they're under the current employment of the CIA, they might not be able to. It might not just be a matter of them risking their careers, but they might be risking their liberty. They might be legally forbidden from coming forward in certain cases. I'm not exactly sure. But getting back to your question, George, about why Trump is allowing himself to be bought off, why is he going along with this Jew d'etat? I don't know. My answer is not any more authoritative than anyone else's. But it seems to me that Trump was elected president. Why? Was it because he necessarily was the best qualified person, had the best plan, had the best connections, was most competent? No, he connected with people. He connected with people, and he had the money to connect with people. That helps. But it seems to me he's really been over his head ever since he got elected. He's been in over his head even before he was inaugurated. And he had trouble putting together any kind of team. And so look at the people he was drawing on. Why on earth would he pick somebody like Nikki Haley?
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, that was a really terrible pick. And how about the replacement for Flynn, McMaster? I wrote a whole article.
He had somebody like Flynn, who was somebody who was on his side. And then Flynn gets pushed out for what? Because he had a conversation with the Russian ambassador to the United States. There's nothing wrong with that. And I guess when asked about it by Vice President Pence, didn't mention every single topic they were talking about. And what is allegedly the topic? Allegedly the topic is General Flynn said, hey, you know, we are going to review some of these sanctions, or we're going to be reviewing our relationship with Russia when we take over. So, you know,
the thing with
I just want to finish. It's in the context of President Obama saying, because the Russians meddled in our election, we are going to launch a cyber attack. He said we are going to conduct a cyber attack against Russia. So for Flynn to go and say, look, you know, that's a very irresponsible statement to say we're going to launch a cyber attack. What could that mean? Shutting down their electrical grid or their missile control systems? What could it mean? It could mean all sorts of things. For him to say, just hold your horses, don't overreact, we'll deal with this when we take over, that would be a very patriotic and responsible thing to do. What Obama did was thoroughly reprehensible. So
I mean, the whole thing with Mike Pence is the puppet theater that you get on television, but I have a hard time believing that someone lying to someone in Washington is grounds for firing them, because if that was true, everyone would be out of a job. So there is definitely something more, something with the CIA. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I like Flynn, politically speaking, but there's something off about him. They might have had blackmail for something.
Or
doing dirty stuff. Yeah.
Dr. Slattery, do you think it's possible that it's just simply a matter of that Trump, even if his intentions were genuine and he wasn't on the side of the Zionists from the get-go, that he really simply just didn't have enough good players to pick from his team, so to speak, in other words. Like, in other words, it's like, you know that movie with the Bad News Bears? Like, mm-hmm. pretty much all the players are bad?
Mm-hmm.
Well, pretty much. I mean, he doesn't have that many good players in Washington. They all seem like, generally speaking, the good people are the exception to the rule. And then once he's in, all these other bad people in his circle, they push out the few decent people. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
Think that's a possibility?
Absolutely. So President Trump was from the business world, particularly the real estate world and the entertainment world. So in the real estate industry, in the entertainment industry, where are you going to find people who have a lot of policy expertise, you know, whether it's healthcare or anything else, but in particular, foreign policy? How is he going to draw on foreign policy experts? I mean, I think if it was someone like Pat Buchanan who won, who is equally an outsider, but is an outsider from Washington, D.C., and has been involved in these issues his whole career, that kind of outsider, or Ralph Nader, or somebody else who's been involved in these issues his whole career, would at least know who to appoint. Whether or not the Senate would approve them is another thing.
Yeah, they know the ropes more, in other words.
They would have a network to draw on. Trump didn't. So what does he do? He defaulted to the Republican establishment. Even though so much of the Republican establishment, the Jewish neocons in particular, had been the never-Trumpers. But the never-Trumpers, for the most part, all of a sudden were like, well, if you can't beat them, join them. And they willingly offered their services. And so you were hearing about Elliot Abrams maybe being the number two person at the State Department, or John Bolton maybe being the number one person. You were hearing this early on. So they were willing to play ball. Meanwhile, his natural allies in foreign policy, which is a small wing of the Democratic Party, people who are attracted to Sanders, not Sanders himself, but people who are attracted to Sanders, they went off on these stupid pussy hat marches. There's a few people, notably Tulsi Gabbard, who went to Trump Tower, and Eric and I had a long talk about her on a previous podcast. She both endorsed her for Secretary of State. And Dennis Kucinich has come out, but otherwise, these people who, to a very large extent, share the vision of foreign policy that Trump expressed during the campaign have ostracized Trump. And so he's been in this corner. He's hired all these people who don't share the vision that he outlined. And like you said, even though a few people like Flynn may have shared it, they were so outnumbered by these other people that they could be outmaneuvered. And so here Trump is, having campaigned on a non-interventionist America First policy, and less than 100 days into his administration, he's done an about-face, and he is just doing, at least now, seemingly doing the neocon bidding.
He's like a hostage now, in other words.
Well, you know, since you were talking about the Bad News Bears before, you want to see a real booger-eating moron. Trump put Rick Perry on the National Security Council. You know, that guy's dumber than a chow-chow. So the Jews were complaining about Steve Bannon on the National Security Council, but they don't say anything about Rick Perry being on there. And that goes to show you that Trump has a very shallow bench to choose from. And yes, he is relying a little too much on the Republican establishment. Although, to be fair, he did appoint Tillerson, who is not from the establishment, but he's seeing the problems with that because Tillerson has a basically an empty office. He doesn't have any people helping him because no one wants the job with him. So it's Tillerson alone as the top diplomat of the United States without any aides or helpers. And he's basically a deer trapped in the headlights. He's trying what he can, but the deep state is a lot stronger. Mm. So we got this whole bundle of contradictions with Trump, and it's interesting to see where it's going to take him, you know?
Yeah, also he's under attack, this nonstop attack from the media, and I really liked the way he was handling it at first. The first couple of weeks he was in office, he was calling CNN fake news. There was a press event at which the New York Times and Washington Post, I believe, and CNN were specifically excluded. And, you know, that was great, but under this nonstop onslaught, coupled with the Watergate-style hearings into Russian connections, which were, you know, on the path of becoming impeachment proceedings, and still could. And people like crazy Congresswoman Maxine Waters from California, she's openly talking about bringing articles of impeachment against Trump. For what? But I think he felt his back was against the wall. He has to have some sort of ruling coalition. And without some sort of minimal support basis, he's not going to get anything passed that needs to be passed. And progressives who might have at least been partial allies on foreign policy, they've turned their back on him. He's not allowed to draw on us for any expertise because we're deplorable. And what's left?
I mean, for Trump and, to a large extent, certain GOP seats in purple states, they need all the white votes they can get. So I think Trump is being okay with that. And I actually agree with Jews that Sean Spicer's comment about Hitler and gas, that it may have been a dog whistle to try and rally the troops, the hidden army of Trump that he doesn't want to associate with but needs. But you know, there's also another side to this. In 2018, there's going to be elections that could possibly shake up Congress and take away the GOP majority if they continue doing this cuck stuff on health care, on tax cuts for the rich. If they keep this monkey business up, they could easily lose seats. I mean, we're seeing this in Georgia. Who would have thought that one of the deepest red states in America for years, you would have a Jew Democrat on the verge of winning in the House of Representatives? He's about to defeat the Republican there. He won 48%.
They were plastering him everywhere, like all over the news. They were talking about this good little Jewish boy down south, you know?
Well, right? You know what the thing is? That Georgia is, in some areas, has changing demographics. So because of that, they have, you know, like a 10% Asian population now, and they have a 15% Mexican, and, you know, they have their blacks from always like 20% or whatever. And the white majority is shrinking. And if you notice, everywhere whites become a smaller majority or a minority, the Jew is always there to take power. You saw this in California. You see this in New York. You see this in Chicago. You see this now in Georgia. I find it absolutely incredible that in Georgia you have a Democrat who's a favorite now to win it for the House of Representatives. And so this is what could hurt Trump in many states if he doesn't do a better job on health care, and soon, and if he doesn't take more populist stances. You know, he's taking some as of late. I believe he was addressing H-1B yesterday and looking into enforcing certain cuts to these kinds of cheap labor visas and stuff, and that's going to help him quite a bit. But there's still a lot more to be desired. He hasn't done much as of yet.
Mm-hmm. And this,
Dr. Slattery.
Yes.
Did you notice, am I the only one who noticed that Trump not only changed in his policies of what he was, you know, with Syria and all this kind of stuff, but also his demeanor when giving speeches and stuff changed? Did you also notice that, like, as if someone gave him, like, a good talking to, and he kind of changed? He didn't have the same passion anymore, the way his expressions
were. If you're talking about the Passover video that he made, that wasn't changing his expression. That looked like a friggin' ISIS hostage video.
Yeah, I know. No, but there was other examples, too. But, yeah, that's the most stark one. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, yeah. What do you think of that?
I'll keep an eye out for that. Since the Jew d'etat, it's been hard for me to watch Trump. So,
yeah.
Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner.
owner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap, but did you know some companies take shortcuts? At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
Are you still looking for that one iodine that you can really trust? A medical doctor-endorsed product that is backed by honest research and true integrative science? Then search no further. Go to NutraMedical.com for Dr. Bill Deagle's Nutriodine, proven time and time again to be the very best iodine available for you. Nutriodine is the only Tesla-activated monatomic plasma iodine in the world. It optimizes mitochondrial function and generation of new mitochondria, from totally neutralizing the venom from a desert recluse spider bite in Southern California to eliminating malaria parasites reported by medical missionaries in Central India. Dr. Bill's Nutriodine is simply the most powerful healing formula there is. Nutriodine clears the body of all known pathogens, restores it to an alkaline state, and even promote stem cell regeneration. Order Dr. Bill's Nutriodine today at 888-212-8871 or visit us online at NutriMedical.com.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap, but did you know some companies take shortcuts? At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
Democrat, who's a favorite now, to win it for the House of Representatives. And so this is what could hurt Trump in many states if he doesn't do a better job on health care, and soon, and if he doesn't take more populist stances. You know, he's taking some as of late. I believe he was addressing H-1B yesterday and looking into enforcing certain cuts to these kinds of cheap labor visas and stuff, and that's going to help him quite a bit. But there's still a lot more to be desired. He hasn't done much as of yet.
Mm-hmm. And this,
Dr. Slattery.
Yes.
Did you notice, am I the only one who noticed that Trump not only changed in his policies of what he was, you know, with Syria and all this kind of stuff, but also his demeanor when giving speeches and stuff changed? Did you also notice that, like, as if someone gave him, like, a good talking to? And he kind of changed. He didn't have the same passion anymore, the way his expressions were.
If you're talking about the Passover video that he made, that wasn't changing his expression. That looked like a friggin' ISIS hostage video.
Yeah, I know. No, but there was other examples, too. But, yeah, that's the most stark one. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. What do you think of that?
I'll keep an eye out for that. Since the Jew d'etat, it's been hard for me to watch Trump. So,
yeah.
I would watch his speeches before because I kind of enjoyed them, and I will watch. Look out for that. That's if that's the case. That's a very interesting observation.
Oh, you didn't see the Passover video he made?
Oh, I couldn't watch that.
Oh God!
I'll have to. But
oh God! I heard it on.
Just the audio of it, taking the first couple of minutes to talk about, you know, the wonderful Jews, and they've been oppressed, and talking about Passover. It's Easter, and he's talking the whole time about Jews.
I mean, what is Passover? Passover is a group of Jewish assassins who killed a bunch of children in the middle of the night. I mean, that's, there's a biblical version of that, but, you know, that's basically Passover. What is so laudable about that?
You know, hey, if you haven't seen it, have you ever seen the South Park version of it with Cartman, and he's the son of the Pharaoh? And
I probably have seen it.
Well, for our listeners, you can find it on YouTube, Cartman Passover video or Cartman South Park Passover. It's really to the point. You wouldn't expect South Park, with one of the two creators being Jewish himself, to get so much to the point, but every now and then they do. You know, they also had an episode about these aliens, the Jewtopians or something like that, and they were really horrible people. But that's another story. We'll get into that. That's something that people, if they have a little bit of extra time, can Google. But yeah, the Passover.
South Park is quite dangerous. I'll tell you why. It appeals to young white males because of the the coarseness and the content. It's relatively politically incorrect, but it's really dangerous because I remember the South Park movie was more or less propaganda back when it came out about 15 years ago, I believe, the South Park movie. George, do you remember when the South Park movie came out?
It was 10 years ago, but I didn't see it when it came out, so I don't remember.
Well, you know, South Park was doing its part in agitating the public, particularly young white males, against Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you recall that, Dr. Slattery.
Well,
but
yeah, I remember that they portrayed Saddam Hussein as basically Satan's gay lover who dominated Satan, right?
Right, and it seems stupid on the surface, you know, and stuff like that. But if you're an 18, 19-year-old, white male, and you see that, you're like, man, that guy really needs to go. Yuck, you know, in some cases for certain people of lesser intelligence. So, you know, they have this concept. It's called the South Park conservative. And it really did. There was the generation before before mine was really marked by this South Park conservatism. It's wearing out now, obviously, with the alternative right. But back then, that was a big deal, South Park. And they're dangerous because they sort of sound like us, but they're not us.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like counter. I don't know, for lack of a better term, I would say counterbalancing. Like they'll say some politically incorrect things about Jews or things that alt-right people would find funny, but then on the other end, they're putting stuff more on the other side to make like Saddam or something more in the benefit of the Jews popular.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, they were really anti-Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that the potty-mouthed vulgarians of South Park would love Trump in every way. He's breaking all the taboos. He says what he feels. And yet, when push came to shove, South Park was extremely anti-Trump.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, they basically made it like that whole thing where, oh, I'm too smart for politics now because, ugh, we got two bad choices, Trump and Hillary. And that was South Park's take on it. They compared it, what was it, a turd sandwich and something stupid like that. And they made a whole series of episodes where they bash Trump and they bash Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think they did the Mel Gibson one, too. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Oof, they went after him like crazy, Mel Gibson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So these guys, you gotta be careful because they'll pull you in just close enough to take you out. You know, they'll take you out.
Well, it's just like neocons. You know, like every now and then a neocon will throw someone in the South a bone and say something against illegal immigration, or will say something against abortion, and then they vote for them. You know,
Right.
They fall for the carnival huckster, and then once he's in power, he throws them into a war, you know?
Yeah.
And gets their kids' legs blown off, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because these Jews, these same Jews, like Jennifer, the Jew from the Washington Post, what's her name?
Rubin, Slattery. Jennifer Rubin.
Yeah, Jennifer Rubin, for years, supports every single war. Who fights these wars? It's young white men from red states. And yet, you look during the Trump election, you looked it was basically a blog. And she's writing these screeds about the death of the white male, white privileged male, the white male problem. And these are the people she needs to fight her Jewish wars.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a certain awakening of that right now where all these people are like, you know, oh, all these Jewish conservatives, they were kissing my ass 10 years ago when I was in Iraq. Now, when I want to express my right to vote and stand up for my own interests, they're degrading, denigrating, attacking, putting down me, my family, and my folk. So there's a certain awakening to that right now, which is embodied by the signs you're seeing at every single protest out there, mm-hmm. from Berkeley to Auburn,
mm-hmm.
and it says, "Da Goyim no."
Right. Now,
Goyim, so no.
You're mentioning these protests, and I want to get to these protests. I want to ask, are we basically in agreement that President Trump, while he was campaigning, was more or less sincere and intended to carry out as much of his proposals, as much of his campaign platform as he could, that he was more or less well-intentioned, and that when he came into office, he was basically maybe in over his head, he was pressured by the nonstop media and, you know, the Russia business, and felt like he had his back against the wall and has either caved in or trying to bite himself some time. Are we more or less agreed on that? And if that's the case, that would indicate that there might be some hope of getting him back. Do you all agree with that?
I'm 100% agreement with you there. I, however, think that he's trying to play some sort of real politic in the government. My take on this is that, you know, some people are saying maybe they're blackmailing him, maybe they're threatening his family, maybe he's falling for Kushner. And I think there might be an element of truth to all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that he really did feel for the people he was talking to, and because there's no real way to fake something like that, to fake that connection that no politician in American history since Andrew Jackson has made with the common people.
Mm.
You can't fake it. I mean, Obama did it, but he did it with, like, women and non-whites. This is different. You know, that's easy to fake. Mm. As a, you know, but, you know, Trump really hit the heartland, and he incited something in people's souls that is not something you see in America at any election. And that's hard to fake. But I do think he's trying to play some kind of strategy. I don't want to call it chess because that's a cliche now. Mm. But I think he's talking to these Jews in the government, and he thinks he can reason with them and say, I'll give you this if you let me do this. Because, you know, they're not letting him govern.
Mm. No, they weren't from the beginning. Is that your assessment, George?
I lean towards this, yes. I mean, I would say I'm not 100% sure, because there's always the remote possibility that he could have been, you know, had a backroom deal with them from the beginning.
Just one thing, not to interrupt you, but Trump just now tweeted veiled support for Le Pen, for example. You know, would a shill do that? Think of it that way, right?
Well, I mean, when you look at it this way, it's the same principle like we were talking about with South Park or the neocons. The Jews might have the plan of getting the red state Randys that were loyal to Trump and convincing them that, you know, Trump is still on your side. And now that Trump says to go send a giant bomb to Afghanistan or bomb Syria or whatever it is, it must be good because he's our guy, you know. And they're trying to channel that fervor that he picked up during the election to keep the support going for these kind of neocon wars, which would have probably been a little more hard to do with some guy like Jeb Bush, for instance, or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's a possibility, you know. Dr. Slattery, do you think that that there's some kind of, let's say, from what you've heard on the ground of people, like the American people, do you think that they're taking the bait with this Syrian war thing right now? I mean, I'm not talking about, of course, you know, Dr. Duke and me and you and the alt-right people, but, you know, the general red state Randy type. What do you think of that?
I'm not quite sure, but I've been really impressed that for the alt-right, that this airstrike on Syria was so huge with them, that so many were willing to just write off Donald Trump immediately because of that, that it had such a big impact. Because
that's good, yeah.
Yeah, because you think back on, you know, a dozen or more years ago, after 9/11, the Iraq invasion, and say the 2004 election, for instance. So you had all of these people who had been going around in anti-war demonstrations, and then when the Democratic primaries come, they rally behind Kerry, John Kerry, reporting for duty, sir, who was pro-war. And it's like, well, okay, he's pro-war, but, you know, what if George Bush makes another appointment to the Supreme Court? What'll happen to a woman's right to choose? I mean, they were showing what their priorities were. And
I don't. Yeah, exactly. You're
and
completely right.
The alt-right in particular, weren't saying, well, you know, we'll trade World War III for a wall on the border. Nobody was saying that. Their priorities were clear. They don't want war. And of course they want a wall. Of course that's not the only thing they want, but that strike, and not just general war, but just that strike on Syria, that by itself got so many people to say, okay, I'm off the Trump train, which is very impressive. Now, regular red state Randys, a lot of them watch Fox News and, you know, other media, and some of them are, they just think, well, if Trump says it's okay, it must be okay. They don't know better yet. But I don't know. It's hard for me to say. It might turn out that way. Now, I wanted to get into this aspect of, well, how would we get him back? And, of course, you know, we write and we make these podcasts. So there's, you know, we try to take on the narrative and provide an alternative narrative. But of course, it's spilling beyond the regular medium or the regular media of communication, spilling into the streets. You had these ridiculous but very large pussy hat demonstrations. And now, you also had the phenomenon of these Antifa people going and attacking anybody that they can, who they see as a target. Well, you saw that at the inauguration, for instance. And now you've got this phenomenon of, you know, a few people, notable personalities who are in the current atmosphere dissidents, whether it's Ann Coulter, whether it's Richard Spencer, and they make a speech, and that becomes a focal point, and then the Antifa come out, and now the new phenomenon of people fighting back against the Antifa. So I know that you've been in touch with, the two of you have been in touch with Matt Heimbach, and you've been following this very carefully. So how important is this now as a new medium of fighting over the narrative?
Well, I think that that the serious strikes for Trump, they had, you know, just to finish that one off, that was sort of like a strategy. I think that it's no coincidence that they appointed Gorsuch to the Supreme Court using the nuclear option at the same time that this was happening. They believe that they could sort of galvanize the base, maybe with the same old neocon tricks of, you know, bomb the crap out of them, you know, that kind of
Rambo.
Stuff.
Rambo.
Yeah, they thought, and I think they miscalibrated that, and they assumed that they would get the Christians on board with Gorsuch, and that they would get, you know, miscellaneous patriotards on board with the Syria strike, and that the alt-right would tolerate it as long as they put out the blueprints for the wall, and they completely miscalibrated all of that, because the guys, the patriotards, I have to say, are, you know, there's that sort of a boomer core that thinks that the Sirius strike is awesome, you know, Bill Mitchell types. But the most vocal elements in Trump media have all condemned it, including Ann Coulter.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a big following.
And she has also a history of being supportive of the Iraq invasion, for instance.
Yeah, she, well, let me tell you something about Coulter. I mean, I like what she's doing now, but, you know, she has a great nose for where the money's going. She can anticipate it. And she realizes that neocon wars are not popular anymore, not even with the old school patriotards that were going around with the bumper stickers that had a mushroom cloud over Iraq. I don't know if you guys remember that. You know, that stuff doesn't fly anymore because the country's broke. We're broke. There's all these people, thousands of people that came back from the war all messed up. And, you know, there's no appetite for that anymore. So Trump really miscalibrated. If this was a public relations stunt, which it sort of looks like, considering they didn't even take the airport out of commission, it was a total miscalibration. And I think that he's smart enough to not repeat that mistake. You know, he listened to Gary Cohn and Jared Kushner and all these Jews in his cabinet whispering in his ear, and they were wrong. You know, and so I think he's going to learn his lesson from that. But yeah, as for the phenomenon of people fighting back in the street, you know, for years people in the nationalist movement have eschewed the street. They said, "Oh, the street, we don't need that anymore. We can just go straight to the government. We can go and start up a think tank in Washington, and that's enough." Well, it goes to show you that it's not enough, because when you do that, some guy with a lip ring and his ears stretched out and a pink mohawk drags you off the podium and beats you up. So, you know, it's the law of the jungle out there. Rights don't. The conservatives claim that rights come from God or from nature. Rights come from the power of the will. If you don't have the will to impose your rights, to protect your rights, you have no rights. It doesn't matter what an institution or a constitution says. If you don't have the muscle, you don't have rights. And this is what people are realizing now, and this is how American Revolution number 2 is going to begin, if it hasn't already. I'm seeing the zeitgeist right now. And I am so excited. I am so excited for this country, so excited for the people, the awakening that's going on. And the Antifas are the first line of defense for the capitalist
system. You know what?
Then the real struggle begins.
Yeah. You know, Eric, and I was going to say this to Dr. Slattery. You know, he talks to Dr. Duke a lot. And, you know, I'm a younger guy. But I remember, like, when Dr. Duke was young, there was this kind of thing where there was a lot more people on the average supporting these kind of conservative ideals than there are today. However, you know, when you look at the 60s and the things that happened in that era, most of the conservatives, they didn't want to get in the streets and deal with the hippies and the counterculture and, you know, fight them in the street. They just had this like, oh, there are principles and, you know, we're just going to... this is what it seems to me anyway. Of course, you know, I wasn't there, but this is the impression I get. And I think part of that was because of the economic situation in the 60s was much better than for younger white people today in the United States. And so now these younger kids they're putting more skin in the game, for lack of a better word. You know, they're angry and they want to get in the street now. They don't want to just sit, you know, back and let these vermin have the streets, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, Dr. Slattery? I mean, comparing the two eras of this.
Well, there may well be less to lose for young people now, especially young white people, being that, you know, what would they have to lose? You have your future to lose if you're young.
Right.
And the future is often bleak. There's less opportunity. There's so many restrictions against whites getting into elite universities, for instance. And that has a ripple effect all the way down. You know, so you don't get into elite university, you get into another school, but it doesn't open as many doors for you, or you just don't get into school in general. And so there may well be something to that. But I wanted to ask you, what you think about the impact on middle America, the impact on people of seeing these images on TV of the Antifa clashing with, and I'm using clashing with, obviously it's really attacking the anybody who is in either supports Trump or supports freedom of speech, but in the media it's portrayed as clashes. How do you think this is impacting people? George or Eric?
Yeah, go ahead, George. You know, I'm from New York, Dr. Slattery, so it's hard for me to really give you a good answer because I don't really have my hand on the pulse of middle America as well as, you know, someone who actually lives there would. But from what I can tell, from what I've seen, at least, you know, secondhand, is that the middle American youth is really suffering right now. You know, factories have closed down. All of this kind of stuff has become a lot more bleak than it was in the old Mayberry days, you know, of the Andy Griffith Show and this kind of thing. So I think I would imagine that when they see this kind of stuff and they see these freaks and then they see somebody finally standing up to them, I would imagine that, you know, they're angry enough now at this point, and they're kind of putting aside these old-fashioned Mayberry pleasantries that they used to have, and they're saying, you know what, this is maybe I'm going to go and get in on that, because, you know, you see a lot of these guys, you know, not just the traditionalist worker party, but just you saw regular, you know, red state type of kids out there that wanted to go there and fight with these little rich kids, you know. That's my take on it, yeah. What do you think, Eric?
I think that, first of all, what we're seeing right now is another thing in terms of the erosion of the middle ground. There's a lot of people historically in America. In fact, the rule in American history is the political fence. That, Voltaire, conservatism, where I say what I believe, and it's not going to really rock the boat too much because I'm nice and polite. And then you say what you believe, and that also won't rock the boat much. But now we see this sort of differentiation between the two political blocks. Now we have the left, which is not the left from yesterday. This is the new left, which is socialist, anti-capitalist, and first and foremost, principally anti-white, anti-normal, anti-family. And then you have the new right, which is also anti-capitalist. It's also fighting the establishment, but it's not doing it for Pepsi Cola like the leftists are. We're fighting for our folk, for the nation, for our place in history. And this sort of compelling feeling that you're fighting for something greater than yourself will always overcome the leftist, the new leftist philosophy, which is I'm going to fight for my trans pony bathroom, and I'm going to fight so that I can marry my dog and go outside in public wearing whatever I want. You know, these are two very, there's one narcissistic side and one selfless side. And the selfless always end up being braver, more brazen, and more dedicated to their cause. So our side is going to prevail, but we need to make sure that the conservatives don't hold us back. That's our main challenge. We're going to win. It's the people in the middle that are the problem.
It's the economic factors, too, I think. Because, you know, when you look at the average person on our side and the average, tranny leftist type, generally speaking, they come from different socioeconomic backgrounds. One is coming from a struggling atmosphere where they're not really too sure about their future, and the other one has a trust fund. You know what I mean?
And the blacks even can sniff that out, because black people don't really have, very sophisticated takes on politics. But if you look at that video that I posted on the Daily Stormer from Auburn, you had that loudmouth tranny talking about how he's going to destroy white privilege. And then this black guy comes up and he's like, yo, what you talking about? Shut up, boy. Pussy-ass white boy. Like, this black guy's flipping out on him. You
saw
that clip. There was a tranny in a tank top, and this black guy comes up to him, and he's this trainee is an Antifa, and this black guy comes up to him, he's like, pussy ass white boy, what are you doing at all, but boy, what are you doing here? Like, black people instinctively hate these Antifas more than even we do, because it's just so such a repulsive sight to bear. And then there's another one. He had one of those millennial new male cuck boy animal hats. Have you seen those, George? Like, it's a cat, and it has like these long earmuffs, and it's like it's shaped like an animal. Yeah. You know, these are the type of infantile morons that black people stab and mug. So